Quam nitya mukta parishuddha vibuddha atma. Kutastha adi purusho bhagavam striya disha. Yad bhudya vishtiti makanditaya svadristya. Rastastita vadimako vyatirikta ase. My Lord, by your unbroken transcendental glance, you are the supreme witness of all stages of intellectual activities. You are eternally liberated. Your existence is situated in pure goodness, and you are existent as in the super soul without change. You are the original personality of Godhead, full with six opulences, and you are eternally the master of the three modes of material nature. Thus, you are always different from the ordinary living entities. As Lord Vishnu, you maintain all the affairs of the entire universe, and yet you stand aloof and are the enjoyer of the results of all sacrifices. Purport by Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. An atheistic argument against the supremacy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead states that if God, the Supreme Person, appears and disappears and sleeps and awakens, then what is the difference between God and the living entity? Dhruva Maharaj is carefully distinguishing the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead from that of the living entities. He points out the following differences. The Lord is eternally liberated. Whenever he appears, even within this material world, he is never entangled by the three modes of material nature. He is known, therefore, as Triadish, the master of the three modes of material nature. In Bhagavad Gita, it is said, Daivi hesha gunamayi mama maya duratyaya. The living entities are all entangled in the three modes of material nature. The external energy of the Lord is very strong. But the Lord is the master of the three modes of material nature, is ever liberated from the action and reactions of those modes. He therefore is uncontaminated, as stated in the Ishopanishad. The contaminations of the material world does not affect the Supreme Godhead. Krishna therefore says in the Bhagavad Gita, that those who are rascals and fools think of him as an ordinary human being, not knowing his parambhavam. Parambhavam refers to his being always transcendentally situated. Material contamination cannot affect him. Another difference between the Lord and the living entity is that a living entity is always in darkness. Even though he may be situated in the mode of goodness, there are still so many things which are unknown to him. But it is not the same for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He knows past, present, and future. and everything that is happening in everyone's heart. Bhagavad Gita confirms this. Vedaham samatithani. The Lord is not part of the soul. He is the unchangeable supreme soul, and the living entities are His parts and parcels. The living entity is forced to appear in this material world under the direction of Daiva Maya. But when the Lord appears, He comes by His own internal potency, Atma Maya. Besides that, a living entity is within the time of past, present, and future. His life has a beginning, a birth, and in the conditioned state, His life ends with death. But the Lord is Adipurusha, the original person. In the Brahma Samhita, Lord Brahma offers His respect to the Adipurusha, Govinda, the original person, who has no beginning. Whereas the creation of this material world does have a beginning. The Vedanta says, Janmad yasya yataha. Everything is born from the Supreme, but the Supreme has no birth. He has all the six opulences in full and beyond comparison. He is the master of material nature. His intelligence is not broken under any circumstance, and He stands aloof, although He is the maintainer of the whole creation. As stated in the Vedas, Katha Upanishad 2.2.13, Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam. The Lord is the supreme maintainer. Living entities are meant to serve Him by offering sacrifices, for He is the rightful enjoyer of the results of all sacrifices. Everyone, therefore, should engage himself in the devotional service of the Lord with his life, his riches, his intelligence, and his words. This is the original constitutional position of the living entities. One should never compare the sleeping of an ordinary living entity to the sleeping of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the causal ocean. There is no stage at which the living entity can compare to the Supreme Person. The Mayavadi philosophers, being unable to adjust to all this, come to the conclusion of impersonalism or voidism. Om Agyan Timidandasya Gyananjana Chalakaya Chakshuru Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tatati Svapadantikam. Today we are reading from the Canto 4 of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 9, entitled Dhruva Maharaj Returns Home. Text 15. Dhruva Maharaj has demonstrated inconceivable power. Such mysticism he was able to manifest that even the residents of Siddhaloka were amazed. The demigods, who have great mystic powers, they were bewildered. mastering the mystic potencies, a small child, he relinquished eating, sleeping, even breathing. He could control his mind to the extent that it was 24 hours a day fixed in the vision of the Supreme Lord's form within his heart. He could stand for a month without moving, as rigid as a pillar, with all the weight of his body on one toe. Class has only been going on a few minutes, and I see you're all moving around. It's very hard to stay in one position for a long time. And he became so heavy that half the earth was being crushed, pushed down by the weight of that toe. By his holding his breath, he was able to withdraw the oxygen, the air, within the universe so that no one else could breathe. Such powers. Who could do this today? Today, if someone can produce a little ashes, or a little gold, or if someone could do a doctor's work without medicine, they claim to be God. People worship them as God. But can they do what Dhruva Maharaj has done? Dhruva Maharaj could actually control his senses. We haven't seen any of these gods able to control their senses. When they can't control their senses, then they just justify their sense gratification in the name of their Rasa Leela. Or something like that. It is all Leela. And we see these people, they're getting old. Every year their hair is getting grayer, unless they put some artificial dye on it, another type of mystic power. They're simply getting old. So Dhruva Maharaj was very powerful, more powerful than any of the self-made gods of today. But yet, when he is standing face to face with the Supreme Lord, he is admitting his own insignificance. In fact, everyone's insignificance before the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Jivatma is eternally Anu, infinitesimal. The Paramatma is eternally Vibhu, unlimitedly great. The living entity can never compare to the Supreme Personality of God. Dhruva Maharaj is giving examples. And Srila Prabhupada, in his beautiful purport, is explaining various arguments that people have in regard to the examples that Dhruva Maharaj is explaining. Krishna is a person. He has desires. And he performs activities. But his activities are above and beyond this material existence. Tribhir Gunamayar Bhavayar. He's above and beyond the three modes of material nature. Prabhupada here calls the Lord Triadish, which means he's the master of the three modes of material nature. Therefore, Krishna says, Daivi Heshu Gunamayi Mama Maya Duratyaya Mami Vamye Papadyante Maya Meta Tarantite. The three modes of material nature are very, very difficult to overcome. You cannot do it. It's so powerful. But if you surrender unto me, you can easily cross beyond these difficulties. Material existence, being controlled by the three modes of material nature, is like a vast, unlimited ocean. You cannot cross over this ocean. It's impossible. The Bhagavata explains that those who try to cross over this ocean with their own intelligence, with their own abilities, however great their mystic powers may be, it's like trying to cross the ocean on a stone boat. How far will you go? You will simply sink. But for those who take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by His miracle, for His devotee, He can reduce the size of the ocean to the water contained in a hoofprint of calf, easily to cross over. Because He is Triadish. He's the master of the modes of nature. We are all forced to take birth in this world according to our previous pious and impious activities. Every aspect of our physical and subtle physical existence is a product of our previous karmas. The family we're born in, the atomic particles that happen to be composing our body, and how they manifest in a gross form, the types of mental and physical sufferings and enjoyments that's coming to our life, our abilities, our inabilities, they are all simply results of past karma. But Krishna describes in Gita that when He appears in this world, janma karma chane divyam, it is transcendental. His appearance, His activities are divine. Transcendental means not under the control of the laws of nature. He is swarat. He is independent. He simply acts according to His sweet will. If you eat indiscriminate foods, then you may take your next birth as a hog. Hogs, nobody chooses with their intelligence to take birth as a hog. It's not that the spirit soul, just before he dies, he signs up with Yamaraj, please, I requisition my next body be a hog. Not like that. Nobody wants hog body. Hogs like hog bodies because they're conditioned, but nobody else likes. You're forced to be a hog due to your previous sins. But Krishna, he becomes Varahadev. He becomes hog. Boar. Boar is a wild hog. But when Krishna becomes hog, he's born not from another hog, not from some female hogini. Simply by his own sweet will, he comes out of Brahma's nose and grows into a hog. And all the sages and all the saints, everybody is offering their obeisances and worshiping him. They can't understand. Who is this? Then he roars like a mountain. And he slashes his tail and whisks his hairs and smiles with his lotus-like eyes. And everyone understands he's the supreme Godhead. He lifts up the earth on top of his tusks. He kills the great Asura, Hiranyaksha, who even Varuna surrenders to, who all the demigods were fearful of. And then after he performs his work, he goes back to Vaikuntha. He doesn't have to die in some gutter like every other hog, or in some slaughterhouse. So Krishna is always God. He's always the supreme controller. When Krishna takes birth, as the son of Devaki, he first appears as Lord Vishnu, fully dressed, holding his four symbols in his four arms. Speaking all transcendental knowledge, explaining past, present, and future to his mother and father. Has any of these self-made gods taken birth like that? Coming out of Brahma's nose, manifesting such a gigantic form, from the very birth, speaking all knowledge? He didn't even come out. He came out of the heart of Devaki. Just appearing. There was no giving birth as we know it today, with all labor pains and sufferings and people giving you all kinds of encouragement. You can make it, you can make it. Just be patient. It's miserable. But Devaki, she was just in bliss. She was in bliss giving birth to Krishna. And then when he became little tiny infant child by his own sweet will, within a couple days he kills the gigantic demoness Putana effortlessly. This is God. This is Krishna. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he appeared in the same way. Simply from the heart of Jagannath Mishra, he just by his own sweet will transported himself to the heart of Sachimata. And then when it was time for birth, he just appeared outside of her. And from his very infancy, he was performing incredible miracles. But by his yogamaya potency, he was preventing people from seeing what was right before their eyes, that he's the supreme absolute truth. That is Krishna. Dhruva Maharaj discusses how Vishnu in the causal ocean is sleeping. Yoga Nidra. But what kind of sleep is Karuno Dakshaya Vishnu? First of all, he's so big in size that from the pores of his body, universes are emanating. Just exhalation, cosmic manifestation is created. Inhalation, it's destroyed. That is Mahavishnu sleep. So people say, If the Supreme Lord sleeps, then what's the difference between him and me? I sleep, so I must also be the Supreme Lord. But what can you create when you sleep? Sometimes you create some obnoxious noise that everyone can't tolerate. After you wake up, the first thing you have to do is brush your teeth, because of the whatever comes into your mouth during that time, and you have to take bath So what are you producing when you sleep? You're not producing universes and cosmic manifestations. How transcendental is your sleep? Vishnu, while he's sleeping, is all-knowing. You become completely unconscious, or you have some crazy dreams which have nothing to do with the reality of your life. Krishna is the supreme reality. And Krishna eats. So atheistic people say, if God is eating like this, and I'm eating, so what is the difference? The difference is he can eat with his eyes. He can eat with his ears. He can eat with his nose. Can you do that? And even your mouth, how much can you eat? Even the world champion eater, how much can he eat? At New Vrindavan, back in the 1970s, there was a nice devotee named Taru. And he was very well known for his eating capacity. It was almost like a mystic power, because he wasn't that big, and he wasn't fat either. He was actually just medium size. But when it came to prasad, one day, in one sitting, he ate 70 big-sized chapatis and 30 full bowls of thick split pea dal. Split pea dal is very heavy. Hare Krishna. We have seen with our own eyes 25 bowls of oats. Nobody could eat more than two. I've seen him eat so much at a Sunday feast that he's unconscious. Everybody, because prasad was not so profuse in those days. You had to be very clever and persistent to overeat. So while he was eating his own plate of prasad, he wasn't looking at his plate. He was looking at everybody else's plate while eating his own prasad. And he was looking in such a way, intense. It wasn't a pleasing, because he was really determined. Dhritavrata. And people would see him looking at their food and they were thinking, I think he wants what I have. And while they were in the middle of taking prasad, he'd saying, if you can't finish that, make sure you give it to me. So anything, anybody couldn't finish in the whole prasadam room, he took. Haribo. So much. Unconscious. And we used to milk cows together. So we used to have to get up early to water the cows. So our regulation actually was we'd get up at 1 o'clock in the morning and chant our rounds. Because everyone had to chant their rounds before Mangalarti, because there was no japa period. And Mangalarti was 4 o'clock, sometimes 4:30. So one time I remember we got up like about 1:30. And the night before, there were Globjamans. And he ate so many Globjamans, I don't know how many. It was something like a little Mahavishnu just consuming all these planets in the form of Globjaman, the time of dissolution. But the difference is, along with the dissolution of the Globjamans, was the dissolution of himself. He was really in a state of type of yoga nidra. So I woke him up and said, Taru Prabhu, it's time to get up. We have to give water to the cows and chant arounds. I said, I can't get up. I said, no, you have to get up. It's our regulation. So we get up, and we have to go outside through all this mud to get to this place where we have to bathe. Ice cold water. It was winter. But in between, you go downstairs, you have to kind of cross the prasad room before going out the door to go to the other place where we would take bath. And there was an entire bucket of the juice of the gulab jamuns. So I'm taking bath and I'm wondering, where is Charu Prabhu? He's not here. So I come back from my bath and I get up, put my clothes in tilak. We used to do it really fast in those days. And I'm going to the temple. In order to get to the temple, you also have to go through the prasadam hall. So on my way, I see him laying in the prasadam hall. He didn't even make it to the bathhouse. I said, Taru, Prabhu, what's wrong? And then he just pointed, and the whole bucket of gulab jamun juice was empty. He drank over a gallon of gulab jamun juice, probably 5 liters. That was after the Sunday feast. And the Sunday feast was at night. So he was quite powerful. But then we read about Krishna. When he becomes Giriraj Govardhan, and he accepts the offerings, he took not just 20 or 30 gulab jamuns. He ate tens and thousands of gulab jamuns. He ate hundreds and thousands of samosas, hundreds and thousands of kachoris, mountains of them. Hundreds of gallons of sweet rice and condensed milks, Shrikhand. Mountains of rice, mountains of sabjis. And he did it all within a matter of seconds. And after eating all that, enough for they prepared enough prasad for the entire civilization of the Brijavasis. Krishna told them what to prepare and how to prepare it and how much. It was prepared for all the Brijavasis. And it describes in Bhagavatam that Krishna had he had millions of cowherd boyfriends. There were millions of gopis. There were millions of parents for the gopis and the cowherd boys. It was a huge civilization. This is described by Bhagavat. And they made enough for everybody. And Krishna took it all within seconds. And he wasn't laying there saying, get me some antacid or something. He was saying, what did he say? Give me more. He was ready to take that much again 1,000 times. They didn't have any more. Literally, everything they had, he ate. Whatever food there was in the entire Braj Bhumi, he ate. And he was asking for more. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, during Mahaprakash Lila, they were giving him tens and thousands of bananas. They were giving him just barrels and after barrel of Ganges water to drink. There was just no end to his eating. He just kept taking it, within seconds. So when people say, if God eats and I eat, so what is the difference? There is a difference. Krishna is unlimited. Krishna has desires. People say, if God has desires and I have desires, what is the difference? The difference is you can never fulfill your desires. And Krishna's, all his desires are, he is Atmarama. He is eternally satisfied. As the controller of all controllers, he can create whatever he desires. Krishna's Ishvara Parama. He is the supreme controller of all controllers. So the Mayavadis, Prabhupada explains herein, that they're unable to adjust this, that God could do such things in such a great way, and he's a person, and we just can't do it that way, and we're persons. So therefore, ultimately, since we can't compare to the Supreme Person, the conclusion is the Supreme Person is an illusion, and we're illusion. So ultimately, you can't become one with the personality of Godhead. The materialistic people, they're thinking, he's doing these things, I'm doing these things, so therefore he's God, I'm God, we're the same. The Mayavadis realize that God is doing things in such a great way, and I cannot ever do it that way. So therefore, in order to become God, they have to annihilate his personality. That ultimately everything is void, everything is impersonal. That's the only way we can compare. But Dhruva Maharaj, who is endowed with full knowledge by the grace of Lord Krishna, he is herein describing his sublime realization of the supreme position of the Absolute Truth and the insignificant position of the Jiva. From the Shastras, Srila Rupa Goswami explains, what is the constitutional nature of the Jivatma? There are 64 principal qualities in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. 50 of those qualities, the Jiva, if he is a completely purified soul, he can manifest in a minute, infinitesimal quantity. These 50 qualities, the Jiva can only manifest them when he's in his perfect state of self-realization, completely purified. And then each quality is infinitesimal, minute particle compared to the unlimited capacity the Supreme Lord manifests these 50 qualities. And 55 of these qualities, Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, they can partially manifest. 60 of the qualities, no one except Lord Narayan can manifest. But only Krishna, the supreme source of all other incarnations, who is Rasaraj, can manifest all 64 qualities. But when Krishna manifests these 64 qualities, he manifests each one as deep and unlimited as an ocean. Inconceivable. Krishna, In Vrindavan, he manifests Lila Madhurya. Unique, sweet pastimes. No Jivatma can, Brahma, Shiva, and even Narayan cannot manifest such sweet pastimes. and Krishna's pastimes, he's subordinate to the love of his devotees. Just like Satyavrat Muni in Padma Purana, he's praying like this: I do not want wealth, elevation to heavens. I do not want mystic powers. I do not want liberation. I'm not concerned with elevation to Vaikuntha. I simply want to remember these sweet pastimes of you as a baby child. Damodar Lila. Being conquered by the devotion of Yashoda Mai. Let those pastimes be forever enacted within my heart. His pastimes are unlimitedly sweet. In Krishna, he has the Premadurya, the most confidential loving devotees, and Venu Madhurya. He plays his flute with such sweetness that it enchants the entire existence. And Rupa Madhurya, his bodily form, his swarup, is so very, very, very enchanting. Even Lord Mahavishnu, you know how he stole that Brahmin's children right when they were born. And the Brahmin, he stole their souls. The children were dead. Such an incredible thing. He just took the soul right out of the body as soon as they were born. All that was left was a dead corpse. So the Brahmin, very much upset, he went to King Ugrasena. So many children are dying one after another. You're the king. You're responsible for this. When you take a position, you have to assume responsibility. Today people want position, but they don't want the responsibility. But in real culture, we have to understand, karmically we are responsible. If one becomes president or prime minister, a substantial percent of all the karma of the entire state that you are ruling over comes on you. That's a pretty intense responsibility. Who would want to be a president or king if they knew that? In Kali Yuga, what kind of sins are going on? And so many sins are legalized. The state legalizes slaughter of animals. Some states legalize abortion, legalize drinking alcohol. So much karma. And a percent of that has to go to the ruler. He's responsible. Similarly, if you're a parent, or if you're a temple commander, or if you're a temple president, or if you're a shiksha guru, or diksha guru, you take a responsibility for people's lives. And if they misbehave, a portion of their response of that responsibility comes on you, both socially and sometimes even karmically. Just like, I think it was about a year ago here in India, there was some big, big scandal in one of the ministries of the central government. So it was some lower worker, and the minister, he probably knew nothing about it, but still he was responsible. And there was a demand that he had to resign, because someone in lower levels of his management were doing corrupt things. He should resign. That's what the world was saying. You're responsible. So the king was responsible for the death of these children, even though directly he had absolutely nothing to do with it. But King Ugrasena, he didn't say, "Don't blame me." He accepted, "Yes, I am. I'm the king. I'm responsible for everything that happens. If there's a criminal, I'm responsible. I have to catch him. If I don't catch him, karma's on me too. If I don't bring him to justice, don't blame anyone else, blame me." That's the way leaders are when they really have integrity. So Arjuna, wanting to protect, "I will protect your next child. With my Gandiva bow, I will stand outside the maternity ward and you will see death will not enter. If it does, I will enter fire." Krishna said to Arjuna, "Why you said like that? You'll enter fire." Arjuna was such a great person. But even he is not all-pervading, all-powerful. He's not God. So when the time came, the child died. So Arjuna, if he didn't find that spirit soul, put it back in that body, more valuable than your life. People would die rather than break their word. Even rascals like Duryodhana. When Bhishma gave those 5 arrows to Duryodhana, he said, "Let me keep the arrows till tomorrow morning. I want to make sure that these arrows kill the Pandavas." So Krishna knows everything. He said, "Let's go get those arrows." So Duryodhana, being a host, they came to his house. He said, "Whatever you want, I'll give you." He made a promise. They said, "Give us those 5 arrows." Now, today, in this part of Kali Yuga, if someone said, "Give me those 5 arrows," he'd say, "I don't have them." you shouldn't listen to all this gossip and rumors that I have arrows. I don't have, there's no arrows here. But he said, "Yes, I have the arrows." And he gave the arrows. Duryodhana was such a duplicitous rascal, but somehow or other he would always do it in such a way that he didn't have to break his promises. So that's integrity. But today, promises, vows, words, they're taken very lightly. When it's convenient to follow, then I will follow. But when it's not convenient, it's impractical. We have to do things according to time, place, and circumstance. And whatever's best for me is what is the standard that should be followed. Now Krishna, he told Yudhisthira to lie. He told Arjuna to cheat. But when it's ordered by Krishna, then it's transcendental. But unfortunately, sometimes devotees, they take those examples to such extreme perversions that Krishna says you could lie. Just see, Yudhisthira, his chariot touched the ground because he didn't lie for Krishna. He did, but he hesitated. So therefore, it's Krishna conscious to lie. It's transcendental. It's a higher ras.
And then when people go and they tell little lies to try to sell books, but then once they get conditioned to lying, then they just become liars. And then they even lie to their god brothers and their god sisters and other Vaishnavas just for their own petty little material desires to be fulfilled, for their own reputation to try to protect. And then there's no question of love and trust when you can't, when people are not honorable, when you don't know whether a person is truthful or not. How can you trust them? The very substance of the fiber of the unity of Vaishnavas is love and trust. You can't really love someone unless you trust them. And you can't trust someone unless they're honest. So therefore, Rupa Goswami explains, we have to be straightforward in our ordinary dealings. Even the most ordinary dealings, we should be very honest. We should be very straightforward. We shouldn't pollute the environment. We should purify the environment. Honesty, truthfulness is the mode of goodness. You cannot transcend the modes of nature until you're situated in the mode of goodness. Therefore, we must live by these principles. And how Arjuna, he was actually willing to end his life because he couldn't keep his promise. So Krishna, konte aprati janihi name bhakta pranashyati. Krishna tells that he protects his devotee. Arjuna wasn't a cheater. He was honest. Out of compassion, he gave his word. And now that he couldn't keep his word, he was willing and ready to take his life. So Krishna said, let's go find your children. So the whole universe they couldn't find. So Krishna just took him directly to the causal ocean. Hare Krishna. When Krishna drives a chariot, he can go anywhere he wants. Can you imagine what a sight that was for Arjuna? Seeing the causal ocean. You know, people find great pleasure going to Chopati Beach to see the Arabian Sea. And I see people are looking, just look how deep and how big this sea is. Causal ocean. It's hundreds of trillions, trillions of trillions of times bigger than any ocean or sea in this world. And Mahavishnu's laying in that ocean. What enormous size. And in this world, when somebody's too big, it looks strange. But yet Mahavishnu, even though he's so big, you cannot calculate in miles or kilometers how there's no number large enough to calculate the size of Mahavishnu. There's no scale that could weigh him. He's Karano Dakshayi Vishnu. He's gigantic. And yet, every limb so beautiful, so attractive. So Mahavishnu said, I took the children. Because I knew Krishna would come here to get them. And I performed this whole pastime because my heart was so much longing to see the beauty of Krishna. So this is Krishna's attraction. It's the most beautiful. Even Krishna, who's the knower of everything, past, present, future, the knower of all living beings, even he is unlimitedly attracted by his own form. There's the story in Dwarka when Krishna saw his reflection in a jewel pillar. And he was thinking, this form is so beautiful. Radharani is so fortunate. She gets to embrace this form. She gets to actually experience the ecstasy of seeing this form and understanding the beauty of this form. I don't know what she is experiencing. Let me become Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the mood of Radharani so I can see this form. I could long to embrace this form. I could understand the ecstasy of seeing me. That is Krishna's beauty. Now, what is the beauty of the people in this world? It's limited and it's temporary. Beautiful people in this world who have beautiful bodily features, in one sense it's a curse. In one sense it's a benediction. It depends. But if you're proud of your beauty and you're attached to it, then there's so much competition. So many other beautiful people. And when you become attached to people being attracted to you, it becomes very difficult to see someone being attracted to somebody else. And then it's temporary. How long does it last? You start getting old, and it comes very fast. Time is just making everything deteriorate. Pretty soon, you're just literally battling and fighting against time. How much you could do it? One great yogi, master of all asanas, old person, he told me he has to perform asanas literally 6 hours every day. Just to keep his body. Because if he misses a day, old age is just setting in on him so much. If he misses a day, he may not ever be able to do these asanas again. 5, 6, 7 hours a day. When he was young, he only had to do it an hour or two a day. But he's just battling against time. He's in his 70s, in his 80s, soon 90s. And ultimately, what is that asana when you lay down? Shavasana. Ultimately, everyone perfectly performs this shavasana. That's about the only asana you can do. You just lay down and you die. Even someone who's never done a day of yoga in their life, at the time of death, they do shavasana very nicely. No moving. So beauty is so much temporary. And you see in Bombay or in America, Hollywood, all these capitals of the film industry, look at the great famous movie actresses who everyone was mad over in the 1950s and 1960s. See them in their movies, those old movies. See how beautiful they are. And now see what they look like when somebody takes a photo of them in the newspapers. They're simply old. And they usually have all kinds of cakes of different cosmetics to try to hide it, but it just can't be hidden. And their fame and glory is just people just having pictures of what they used to look like in their house. And say, you see, like that, and like that, and like that. And people say, well, what about that? Don't worry, just keep looking at the photos. They live for their past because what they're so attached to, they don't have anymore. But Krishna's beauty, he is Navayovanam Cha. He is eternally youthful. Thus, Dhruva Maharaj, in so many ways, he is describing the difference between the Jivatma and this Paramatma. The Jivatma in the spiritual world, in his Swarup, when he actually attains the Siddha Deha, the spirit soul also has an eternally youthful form. And that's why everyone wants to stay youthful in this world, because that's really, it's our nature to be eternal. But in the spiritual world, all these beautiful, youthful forms of the unlimited jivatmas, they are all fully conscious that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, and our existence is simply meant for his enjoyment. That is perfection. Until you realize that Krishna is the supreme and only enjoyer, and we are all his parts and parcels, his eternal servants, meant for his enjoyment, then you cannot realize your own eternal, blissful identity. Sarvadharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam vraja. The real virtues and glories of the soul can only be understood and directly experienced when we surrender wholeheartedly to Krishna. Aishwaryasya samagrasya. Krishna possesses all six opulences in full to an unlimited degree. We have a little beauty, but we're not all beautiful. When Krishna is in Vrindavan, everyone was attracted to him. The cows. When Krishna would bring the cows from the pasture grounds back to Nandagaon, it is described that actually the calves, you know how much a mother loves its calves. The calves are crying for milk. And the cows, the mother cows, they hear the calves crying for milk. They just want to run to lick the bodies of their calves, and just their udders are filled up with milk out of affection. They just want to feed their little children just unlimited milk just to satisfy their children. So the front legs would be running to meet their little calves. But their back legs, they didn't want to leave Krishna, so they would not cooperate with the front legs. The front legs would be running forward, the back legs would be running backward. So even the cows were attracted to Krishna's beauty. The deers would stand with unblinking eyes looking at the beauty of Krishna. We discussed the other day about the parrots. Their unlimited attraction, not only to Krishna, but even Krishna's footprints in the ground. Everyone's attracted to Krishna. But however beautiful you are, you're not attractive to everyone. Some people may say you're attractive, but other people from some other race, they think you have the wrong shaped eyes. You're not really attractive. And the cows, they couldn't care less about what you look like. What to speak of the insects and the birds. Have you ever seen these movie actresses or movie actors, Mr. America or Miss India? Did you ever see swarms of bees coming to drink the nectar of their beauty, and birds fluttering all around them, weeping tears of ecstasy seeing them, and cows gathering around them, and deers licking their bodies, and human beings falling unconscious, and hair standing on end, and becoming stunned and rolling on the ground and chanting their holy names. What is the use of their beauty? Krishna's beauty is unlimited for everyone. Therefore, that beauty never ends. Husband is very much attracted to the wife, sometimes. This is what I have read in the scriptures. But as she gets old, then it's not, oh, you are so beautiful. It's somehow or other, let's tolerate each other. But the love affairs of Radha and Krishna, the love affairs of all the living entities in Krishna and the spiritual world, it's ever increasing. Krishna's opulence of beauty is, it's ever increasing. Nothing is stagnant. And the perception in the bliss of every living entity in their perfect state of bhakti is ever increasing, relishing the beauty of Krishna. And being enjoyed by, actually, when a devotee sees the beauty of Krishna, the devotee becomes conquered by that beauty. That means he's actually being enjoyed by the beauty. What does it mean to be conquered? When one nation conquers the other, that means you become controlled by those people who conquer you. And ultimately, you become enjoyed by the people who conquer you. So when Krishna's beauty conquers someone, that means Krishna's beauty is enjoying you unlimitedly. And because you're being enjoyed by Krishna's beauty, you experience unlimited bliss. This is the difference between material consciousness and spiritual consciousness. Material consciousness is our happiness is enjoying. But in the spiritual world, nobody wants to enjoy. Everyone simply wants to be enjoyed. And there's unlimited bliss in being enjoyed, giving bliss to Krishna. Krishna possesses the supreme opulence of wealth. We don't own anything. Everything is the property of God. If we claim that anything is our own, we have to take another birth. Until we genuinely, from our heart, realize everything is Krishna's and everything is for Krishna's service, we have to take another birth. And in this material world, the more wealth you have, along with it comes so many anxieties and frustrations. Sometimes you don't know who to trust. You think people are trying to exploit you. You think people are trying to use you. Sometimes families fight and become enemies over the wealth. And you're trying to hold on to it. And there's so many circumstances in which you can lose it that are beyond your control. And ultimately you're going to die and everything will be taken away. So to the degree you're attached to your wealth, to that degree you're afraid of death. But Krishna is the proprietor of everything for all time. And he never dies. So he's really wealthy man. Supreme wealth. And his knowledge, his renunciation, his fame, it is unlimited. and eternal. That is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is the very basis of real bhakti. There are many people who talk about bhakti. Even impersonalists, sometimes they teach the path of bhakti. Because they feel that they'll get a lot of followers this way. Because actually bhakti is pleasing to the heart. So people try to attract people through bhakti. But the conclusion of their bhakti is there's many paths. Whether you follow jnana yoga or karma yoga or astanga yoga, and within these there are so many divisions and subdivisions, or whether you do bhakti yoga, it's all the same. They're just different ways of approaching the one supreme, homogeneous, all-pervading, undifferentiated Brahman. But real bhakti is based on this foundation, that Krishna is eternally a person. And he has these six opulences, which are unlimited, inconceivable, and eternal. And that is the difference between Krishna and the living entity. Therefore, we are all meant to be controlled by Krishna. We are all meant to be enjoyed by Krishna through pure devotion, service. Most people, they translate bhakti as devotion. But our acharyas, they translate it as devotional service. Because there's no question of real devotion unless we accept the role of a servant to please the master. That is bhakti. And unless we accept we are eternally the servant, then we haven't understood what is bhakti. This is Dhruva Maharaja's realization. He had great supernatural powers, and all the people worship by millions of unfortunate souls as God in the world. He had more poetic transcendental knowledge of scripture than any pundit's world. He was more detached in his austerities than any of the yogis, the vairagyas of this world. He had a state of indifference to material nature, mukti, liberation, than any of the so-called liberated persons of this world. And here is conjunction. That God is great and we are eternally his tiny infinitesimal parts and parcels. We are eternally his servant. We can never be compared to God. We should never try to be God. We should simply surrender to Krishna with our hearts and souls. Is there any questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you for a wonderful class, Maharaj, glorifying different aspects of Krishna being unlimited and Jiva's so much limited. So I'm so much limited, so I try to ask you this question. In the translation of the verse today, it's stated by Dhruva Maharaj that the Supreme Lord is the supreme witness of all stages of intellectual, of all activities, all stages of intellectual activities. So what are the different stages of intellectual activities that Dhruva Maharaj is referring to here, and how can we understand them according to the context of this class, relationship to the jiva, in relationship to the Supreme Lord.
Where is this in the purport?
In the translation of the verse.
Acha. By your unbroken transcendental glance, you are the supreme witness of all stages of intellectual activities. In essence, this means Krishna knows everything. His unbroken glance, that means he is seeing everything and everyone at all times. Never for the slightest moment is Krishna not seeing you, seeing everyone. In one sense, the subtlest activities of a human being is his intellectual activities. The ego is the subtlest element, and the ego in a subtle platform, it manifests its desires into intellectual platform. Intellect is subtler than the mind. Mind is subtler than the senses. So even the subtlest, most thoughts of every living entity, Krishna is constantly changing. Unbroken. Our eyes close. What is winking eyes? Can't stop it. The eyes can't survive unless they blink. Gopis, they're thinking that blinking of eye is like 12 years or more because it blocks their vision of Krishna. Just now in the class, there's people who are in a permanent state of blinking. I am seeing, which is usually Krishna's indication that I should stop. So we can't see continuous, whoever we are. But Krishna sees continuously. His glance is on everyone in the heart as Paramatma. He doesn't blink. He's watching. He's seeing. Everything you do, everything you speak, every thought, every desire is the witness. And your spiritual advancement is based on what the Paramatma is seeing. Not what the world around you is seeing. We can fool people. Sahaj, prakrita sahajas. They try to fool people that I'm very advanced. Manifesting X. But in their hearts, they have so many desires. And even in their lives, they have staged materialistic activities secretly. It's like Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, there is that story. He's just sitting in his kutir in the middle of the night, and he just starts screaming out, "You rascal, you nonsense!" And somebody said, "What are you, Babaji Maharaj, what's happening?" He tells, this yogi, this Babaji, he claims to be always in his siddha deha, giving out the siddha pranalis, thinking himself so advanced. But I know right now, at this very moment, he's having illicit sex with some widow. So devotees, some people went there and they found, sure enough, there he was, secretly. So Krishna revealed that to Gaur Kishore Das Babaji Maharaj. So you can fool people. But your spiritual advancement is not going to be based on how you look advanced to the people of this world. Your spiritual advancement is going to be based on the honesty and sincerity that Krishna is seeing as the Paramatma in your heart. If you're proud, if you're enjoying recognition, reputation, that I'm a very advanced soul, yes, people will honor you. But Krishna's inside your heart, seeing your desire, seeing how you're responding to different situations. So this lesson of Dhruva Maharaj is very important. Krishna is watching everything. And that same Krishna is in the heart of everyone. One time they asked Srila Prabhupada, "Do you know everything about me? Do you know every one of my thoughts?" Srila Prabhupada said, "I know whatever the Paramatma wants me to know of how to help you." He didn't claim to be all-pervading. Krishna's all-pervading. And because he surrendered to Krishna and he's trying to help devotees, Krishna gives him the knowledge by which he can help devotees. So actually, if we're sincere, to really make spiritual advancement, not to become famous as a Vaishnav, but to actually develop real love, if that is our motive, then we should not evaluate our performance on the basis of what other people see and what other people tell us about ourselves. To some extent, we must. If somebody says, "Prabhu, you're in Maya," we should think, "Paramatma is speaking through that person. I am in Maya." Even the great souls think they're in Maya. But a neophyte devotee says, "Ah, what do you mean, me, Maya? I chant my rounds. I have so many people that respect me. How you say I'm in Maya?" But the great personalities, you tell them they're in Maya, "Yes, Prabhu, please save me." From their heart, they're humble. When people praise us, we should understand Krishna's watching. What is our honesty? What is our sincerity? What is our actual determination to really become Krishna conscious, to really adhere to the vows we've made? Our spiritual advancement is totally dependent on Krishna's observation of our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. He is the supreme witness of all stages of intellectual activities. Thinking, feeling, willing, accepting, rejecting, discriminating. Krishna's seeing it all. Are we cheating? Are we honestly trying to serve? Are we striving to be humble? Trinadapi sunichena taror iva sahishtuna amanina manadena kirtaniya sada. To that extent, we're striving for these truly spiritual virtues. Krishna will preserve what we have and he will carry what we lack if we're honest and sincere. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.